So my friends, today I thought I would share some teaching stories, sacred poetry, and I will follow a template which is prevalent in Islamic spirituality or mysticism. You know, that 13th century sage Rumi, he says that there is a kiss we want all our lives. There is a kiss we want all our lives, a touch of spirit on the body. Or as that 8th, 9th century beloved female saint expressed, you know, there is a disease in my breast no doctor can cure. Only a union with that friend can cure it. My friends, is it still a thumb up in hearing? Okay. Wonderful. So the first question in this outline of mysticism or spirituality is, when did I become a seeker? When did I turn to the need for what we might call spirituality? You know, in the Quran, there's a wonderful verse that says, there comes a time in your life when, the Quran says, you'll begin to find something emerging from within. Say, my life, my living, my prayers, my sacrifice are all for you, my sustainer. If you don't like the word God, it's really about then divine attributes of God, like truth, justice, compassion. What was some events or a singular event in your life that brought about this, what is called the sacred turning? Let me give you some examples. You know, Mahatma Gandhi in India was a very timid person growing up as a child. Somehow he forced himself to become a lawyer, but on the very first day, when he was advocating, that timidness, that shyness, that feeling of scare within him, it caught up with him. He became unconscious and he fell to the ground. And he felt so humiliated, shamed. I'm good for nothing. And then he read a beautiful sentence in the Hindu scriptures, truth is God. Truth is God. And he told himself, if I become truthful, live the truth, I might be blessed with divine qualities. And that was one of those things that turned him towards spirituality. It could be meeting a teacher, a special person or persons in your life. Rumi met his teacher, Shams-e Tabriz. It could be a burning question that could change your life. Like the Buddha had this burning question, why would a mother want to give birth to a child who would inevitably grow old, become sick, and die? Why? And that question took him on an adventure, on a search for 7 years, after which he became enlightened. What was it for you on the timeline of your life? For me, it was a singular event. In 1991, unexpectedly, my mother passed away. In 20 days' time, my father, who was very close to my mother, they were very close as a couple, he had a heart attack and he died. And that woke me up. It reminded me of that wonderful verse from the 14th century Hafiz, a very well-known Sufi poet, who says, something missing in my heart tonight, something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need for God absolutely clear. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender. My need for God, absolutely clear. So I'll pause for a few moments here, just a few seconds. Ask yourself, on the timeline of my life, what were those moments? A question, an insight, an encounter, an event that made me turn in the direction of spirituality. I'll be quiet now. Okay. So now, the next point in this outline of spirituality, mysticism, is you come to a point where the Islamic mystics say you want to engage in a divine exchange. What is this divine exchange? I want to bring spirituality or divinity or divine qualities into my life in exchange for my ego. The I, me, me, me. We need the ego, but to tame it. I want to make this divine exchange. You know, to explain this, Rumi has this story of the lover and the beloved. The lover is searching for his or her beloved, finally finds a place where his beloved is, knocks on the door, and the beloved from inside the room says, "Who is it? Who is it?" And the lover says, "It's I, it's I." And the beloved says, "Go away. There's no space for you here. There's no place for you." And the lover is very confused and goes away. And after many years, having learned many lessons in life, comes back again to the beloved's door and knocks. And the beloved says, "Who is it?" And the lover says, "It's you, it's you." And the beloved says, "Welcome, welcome. There's space enough for both of us." The divine exchange. You know, I love the poetry of Rumi, who says, "Where will you find a customer like God, who pays in gold, who accepts your counterfeit coins, buys your dirty, shabby bag of goods, and in return gives a spiritual spring so delicious that even sugar is jealous of its sweetness?" So he continues, "For God's sake, for your own sake, sell and buy at once. Where will you find a divine market like this? For one weak breath, the divine breath. For one little seed, the entire rose garden." Just be with this for a few moments and ask yourself, how does this apply to my life? Well, as I'm sitting here right now, this would mean for me, as I'm speaking to you, you know, wise insights from here and there. Am I trying to impress you, let you know how wonderful, how wise I am, coming from my ego? And that's okay. Or am I coming from my higher self, my divine spark, that simply wants to share some insights that could be of use to you? In the course of my daily life, am I coming from my ego or am I coming from my higher self? And we have a choice every moment of the day. You know, the Prophet Muhammad had this saying that every day as you set out, you're either suppressing your soul or emancipating, freeing your soul. Let me give you another example. For me, this really resonated. There's a wonderful saying in the Eastern traditions, "Whosever approval you seek, you become their prisoner." So I'll repeat. It's not a question of good or bad. It's a law of the created world. "Whosever approval you seek, you become their prisoner." Just be with it. Whosever approval you seek, you become their prisoner. Nothing to do with good or bad. It just is. And so the Islamic mystics come up with this saying, "Therefore, Choose your jailers with care and deliberation. Choose your jailers with care and deliberation. Okay, next point I want to make is the Sufis are people who are really focused on the spirituality of Islam. Sufis say, you really want to grow faith. What is faith? And the Sufis say, to really attain to authentic faith, you have to move from borrowed certainty to an inner knowing. I repeat, it's a journey. If you want to build faith in the invisible world, in God, in divine qualities, if you want to build faith, you have to move from borrowed certainty to inner knowing. You know, in the Native American tradition, this is how they describe the journey of faith. When I hear something, I remember it. When I see something, I understand it. When I experience something, I know it. So in the Quran, faith, building faith has three stages. The first one is hearsay. But you got to move beyond that. And the Quran says, have experiences. You have a conscience. If you make a mistake, grow from it, learn from it. By the way, I'm thinking of another story, a true story. A disciple goes to his teacher and says, oh teacher, I'm so glad I've studied under you because of your teaching, whenever I come across an important decision I have to make or to do something, I think not once, not twice, but three times. What did the master say? Once is enough. Meaning, don't make an excuse not to have experiences. And the third stage, the Quran says, in faith is, once you learn from your experiences, something grows from within you that creates faith. A wonderful Bengali poet, the first Asian to win the Nobel Prize in literature, it's a long name, Rabindranath Tagore. He has his beautiful poetry. He says, faith is the bird that sings in the dark, knowing that dawn is coming. Faith is the bird that sings in the dark, knowing that dawn is coming. Let me give you another example. Story of the moth and the flame of the candle. The moth hears there is this beautiful radiance, the flame. The moth then flies and sees the flame. And then the moth goes inside the flame and burns with that experience. So I'll be quiet again here. What is your understanding of faith? What has grown your faith? Build your faith. How have you attained faith? I'll be still for a few seconds. Okay. The next one in Islamic mysticism is called Ihsan. It's about becoming a more beautiful human being, which Sufis say it's really about, if you want to become more Christ-like, Buddha-like, Elohim-like, Allah-like, Krishna-like, which is one of our main reasons we are here on planet Earth, to become a more complete, developed, mature human being, we have no choice but to do what is called the inner inconvenient work. I repeat, we have no choice if I want to become more Christ-like.
to do the inner inconvenient work.
Let me give you a gentle example of that. Some say, you know, it's a true story of Rabia, they say, that 8th, 9th century beloved female sage. In those days, of course, no electricity, and she is looking for a lost key under a pillar of fire. Looking. She's so well known, the entire town or village joins her in trying to help her find the key. They cannot find the key. And so finally, one of the searchers says, beloved Rabia, to better direct and focus our search, can you tell us whereabouts in this area you think you lost your key? What did Rabia say? Actually, I did not lose my key here, where there is some fire on the pillar. I lost my key miles away in my house over there. They say, really? Then why are you looking for it here? They said, simple, she says. My house has no light at all, but there's so much light out here. And they laugh. And she says, you laugh, which tells me you are intelligent people. Then she says, you tell me now. She tells those people, when you have lost your peace of mind, your contentment, your happiness, because of a failed relationship out there, or a plan that did not work out there, something did not manifest out there. Did you lose it out there? Really? Or did you really lose it inside you? But of course, it's much more dim. The light is much more dim. Yes, it's important you look for it outside, but where you really lost it was inside you. And it's much more inconvenient to look for it inside you. So what is this inner work we're all asked to do? The great sages from all traditions say two things. One is, we have to transform our ego. And the second one is, we have to purify and open our heart. I said earlier, we need our ego to survive, to function. But the danger is, the ego can sometimes incline us towards wrongdoing. So the Sufis say this is the work of transforming the ego. You've got to tame the ego from a commanding master into a personal assistant. From a commanding master into a personal assistant. How do you do that? I will quote the Sufis who say, by compassionate self-witnessing, by shining a light of compassionate awareness on myself, compassionately. See, the Hindus say, in the Hindu scriptures, they say, we are like two birds on the branch of a tree. One bird is pecking away at the fruit. The fruit could be sweet, the fruit could be bitter. That's life. But I'm also the other bird on the same branch, observing myself non-judgmentally, witnessing myself. So I know what changes I have to make. You see, how will I ever tame my ego unless I witness it, I observe it compassionately? I say compassionately because that is when I will really do the work which creates those changes. My pride, my arrogance, how will I ever tame that unless I'm aware of it? So I'm going to introduce here a very beloved fictional character in Islamic mysticism, fictional from 13th century on.
who laughs at himself, and through him, many profound truths are conveyed. So every story of his, he has a variety of names. He's mainly known as Mulla Nasruddin. So here's a story, which has many layers of meaning. On a moonlit night, the mullah is on his constitutional walk. He happens to pass by a well. He looks inside, peers inside, and is shocked, stunned. Why is he shocked? The moon has fallen into the well. He says, "Sister Moon, fear not." He goes home, gets a rope, ties a hook. He flings it into the well. It probably catches something. He heaves and pulls. Something comes loose, and he falls on his back. And he sees the moon restored to its proper domain. And he says, "Thank God I came along." So what is this story about? The ego has an exaggerated opinion about itself. Just be with that story. How will I ever know that unless I observe myself with compassion? Here's a story about greed. There's a beggar who actually is a sage disguised as a beggar who for days and weeks and months, he's always begging outside the king's palace. One day the king says, "Bring that beggar inside. I want to satisfy his needs and send him away." So the beggar comes with his little bowl, and the king says, "I'm going to fill up your bowl with gold and jewels." He pours gold and jewels into the bowl, but magically, amazingly, it disappears. It gets swallowed. The king puts more gold coins, silver, jewels into that little bowl. Again, it gets swallowed up, disappears. The king says, "What is this?" And the beggar says, "Your Majesty, this is the bowl of your ego. Whatever you put into it, it gets swallowed up. It is never satisfied. It is never satisfied. If you understand this, if you really understand this, you will be an emperor. If you don't understand this, you will be a beggar." The Buddha had this famous saying, "The rain could turn to gold. The rain could turn to gold, but this would still not satisfy your desires." A wonderful sage in Islam says, you give somebody two valleys of gold, and he or she will still yearn for a third valley of gold. Just be with that. Well, let me give you one more. You know, we are stuck in our patterns of behavior. We blame this person, we blame bad luck, a situation. We don't look within ourselves. This is a favorite mullah story of the interfaith amigos as we make presentations. The mullah goes to work. At lunchtime, he opens his lunch pail box. What does he find? A cheese sandwich. Second day, third day, fourth day, it's always a lousy cheese sandwich. On the 10th day, he opens it up. Another lousy cheese sandwich. So his puzzled co-worker said, "Mullah, why don't you ask your wife? You can be persuasive. Be gentle. Tell your wife to make you a different kind of sandwich." What does the mullah say? "I'm not married. Who makes them? I do." So just be with that. Rumi says, in his utterances, "Marry your soul. That wedding is the way." Meaning, align your personality, which is nothing more than a bundle of conditioned reactions to life circumstances, to come closer and closer to your higher self, your divine spark. It's constant work every hour, every day, every week, every month, aligning your personality with your soul or higher self. Just be with it for a few moments. Okay, I said something about the heart. The two metaphors. One is, the Quran says, purify your heart. The Quran says, when you have a wrong thought, negative, evil thought, or evil behavior, this creates a rust, a stain on your heart. And the Prophet Muhammad said, for every rust, there is a polish. And the polish for the rust of the heart is remembrance of God. Meaning, use God's solvents like patience, compassion, forgiveness, service to polish the heart. Purify the heart. The Quran says, bring to God a sound heart, and suggests, what can you bring to God? Everything you have is from divinity. All you can bring to God is a polished heart, so that the face of Allah is reflected in it. Bring a polished heart, so the face of divinity is reflected in it. But it's not easy work. Again, a poetry by Rumi. Jamal, if you get irritated by every rub, if you get irritated by every rub, how will the mirror of your heart ever be polished? If you get irritated by every rub, how will the mirror of your heart ever be polished? The other metaphor is to open your heart. The best way to do this is to embrace not only your 10,000 joys of life, but the 10,000 sorrows of life. Meaning, the Quran says every feeling comes from God. Therefore, all feelings are sacred. May I also embrace my difficult feelings? And there are a lot of spiritual processes, how you do that. And allow your heart to break. Don't run towards pain and suffering, just don't run away from it. Don't run towards pain and suffering, just don't run away from it. You know, again, there's a mystical saying in Islam, take a pickaxe and break open your stony heart. Take a pickaxe and break open your stony heart. The heart's matrix is glutted with rubies. Springs of laughter are buried in your chest. And why is it important to create that inner spaciousness, that unclenching of the heart? Let's listen to the Buddha. The Buddha says, if you have a glass of water, it's a contained space, you put a lot of salt into it, you drink it, it tastes bitter, salty. What happens if you take the same amount of salt and pour it into a larger space, the lake? You no longer are feeling the taste of that bitterness because of that large space. And all the sages say, when you open your heart, create that inner spaciousness, there is so much more room for joy to flow into it. Joy, intimacy, love, beauty, because there's so much more space. Khalil Gibran, that Christian mystic, that Lebanese Christian mystic, Khalil Gibran, he said, the more that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy it can contain. But I repeat that wonderful, critical understanding. Don't run towards pain and suffering. Just don't run away from it. Just be with that for a few moments. How can I open my heart? Through purification, through embracing not only my joys, but also my sorrow in my life. Okay, let me come to the topic of mystery of God. None of us can understand God. You know, some of us don't believe in God, but there's a higher intelligence. Call it whatever you will. Call it mystery. There's a verse in the Quran that says, if all the trees in the universe became pens and all the seven oceans became ink and they were depleted and you replenished them and you began to write out the mystery of God or just mystery, you wouldn't come close to describing a fraction of the fraction of the fraction of the mystery of this higher intelligence. You know, when Rumi, he saw this verse, you know, Rumi would go into a trance, the 13th century Islamic sage, and he uttered, in these matters of the invisible world, he uttered, sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment. Sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment. About mystery, about God, about divinity, what does the Tao say, you know, or in the Tao Te Ching, what does it say in Taoism? About God, it says, those who say do not know. And those who know do not say. There's another verse from the Quran I like very much. It says, Allah, the God of all of humanity, is closer to you than your jugular vein. That higher intelligence, spirit, divinity, is closer to you than your jugular vein. Access to this higher intelligence is in the here and now. There's a true story of that beloved female saint, Rabia. She's walking the streets and she came across this master, a very famous Sufi sheikh, who was teaching his adoring students. And he was telling them, you know, God is so compassionate. God is so compassionate. Allah is so compassionate. Keep on knocking on God's door. Keep on knocking on God's door. Keep on knocking, knocking, knocking on God's door. And one day, the door will open. And Rabia said, oh, master, oh, teacher, when was the door ever closed? And teacher stands up and bows to her. And that's the end of that story. My friends, I'm looking at the time, and I'll move on just with a few more points. At this stage, I would normally talk about the prophet's mystical experiences, but let me just summarize by saying that one insight is about silence. Do we need silence? Again, the Islamic mystics, they say, we human beings are like fish out of water, thrashing and quivering on the banks. And from time to time, we need to dive into those oceans of silence. What is silence? Again, Rumi. Silence is not the absence of sound. Silence is not the absence of sound. It is the absence of the little self. I, me, me, me. He goes on. Silence is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. Silence is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. Therefore, the mystics go on, Jamal, close down speech's door. Be silent. Be silent so that the Lord who gave you language may speak. For as she fashioned a door and a lock, he also made a key. So ask yourself, am I practicing silence? See, the Buddha, he was very clear about this. He said, if you really want to become enlightened, you have to practice silence in your own way. There's a story, we don't know if it's true or not, but it's repeated quite often. Someone asked the Buddha, what did you gain from silence and meditation? And the Buddha said, nothing at all. Nothing at all. And they were all so shocked and said, why do you make us practice silence 3 times a day? And the Buddha said, but let me tell you what I have lost in meditation, what I have lost in silence. I have lost my fear of death, my greed, my anxiety, my depression. That is why I meditate, practice silence. Okay, very quickly, I'm getting into prayers, but because of time, I'll just shorten it. A full way to engage in prayers is to choose a mantra and repeat it again and again. Like for me, Allah, Allah, La ilaha illallah. For Buddhists, Om Mani Padme Hum. Or just say love, love, love. If you repeat a sacred mantra within you again and again and again and again and again, it's a beautiful form of prayer that could change your life. But you might ask, why would it work? So here's a metaphor from the different traditions. There is a pot or a vat of dye, D-Y-E, color. A pot of color. Take a cloth, dip it into that vat of dye, take it out. It has a beautiful color. But what happens? Over time, it fades away. But what happens if I dip this cloth in this vat of dye again and again and again and again and again and again and again? There comes a time this color on the cloth becomes permanent, color fast. When I repeat this verse within me again and again, or do some spiritual practice again and again and again, you might think nothing is happening, but there comes a time it colors you. That is why the Quran says, who has a better dye? There's the exact translation, who has a better dye than God? But repeat it again and again and again. Let me give another example from the Hindu tradition. You know, in India, festivals are very popular, but usually it involves elephants. What's the problem? The problem is the trunk of the elephant, it sways wildly all the time. It overturns some stalls, some weak stalls that have food. It lashes at those onlookers. So some people went to these gurus in the mountain, not expecting a correct, a full answer. They said, oh guru, you have such knowledge, such wisdom. Is there any way we can overcome this nonsensical swaying of the trunk of the elephant? And to the utter shock, guru said, yes. Really? What do we do? The guru said, it's simple. Take a stick of any size, place it in the trunk of the elephant, see what happens. They placed a stick in the trunk of the elephant, which curled it up, and lo and behold, the swing became less and less and less and less and less. So another beauty of repeating a mantra again and again is it reduces the swaying of all those unnecessary thoughts and images and fears, what is called the rattle of the cage of monkeys. It becomes less and less and less and less. Okay, my friends, another quick point is being of service. I'll quote Tagore, who says, I slept and dreamt life was joy. I slept and dreamt life was joy. I awoke and found life was service. I served and behold, service was joy. Now, quote one more hadith, a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, which gives a lot of practical value to be of service to others. The Prophet Muhammad said, Do good deeds according to your capacity. God never tires of giving rewards unless you tire of doing good deeds. The good deeds most loved by God are the ones that are done regularly, no matter how small they are. The good deeds most loved by God are the ones that are done regularly, no matter how small they are. Just a few seconds, ask yourself, what are some good deeds I could be doing according to my capacity, regularly, no matter how small they are? Okay, I've skipped several points. I'll come to one last point in this outline. The utter need for community. You see, it is commonly said, even prophets needed companions. Rumi says, please come out of the circle of time and enter in the circle of love. Who is it in my life that passes three gateways? There is love between us, affection between us, number one. Number two, there is trust. Without trust, there is no ability to be vulnerable. Without vulnerability, there is no real community. And the third one is a love of truth. Like the Buddha said, find friends who love the truth, whatever that means. Love, trust, and aspiration for the truth. Prophet Muhammad said, your spiritual practices are only as good as those of your close friends. Therefore, choose your close friends wisely. Okay, I want to end on with a very brief story about time. We always need to value time. I've gone beyond my time. I didn't value my time. So let me make it up by telling this story. The mullah is in London Museum. And here is this very famous professor pointing to these artifacts. And the professor says, this is 5,000 years old. The mullah raises his hand. Excuse me, sir. It's 5,004 years old. The guide is a little annoyed. Goes on to another object. Says, this is 50,000 years old. Mullah says, excuse me. It's 50,004 years old. Now he's really annoyed. Happened the third time. This is 100,000 years old. And the mullah says, excuse me. It's 100,004 years old. And now he's really upset, this professor, this guide. He says, sir, you have a beard, you have a turban, you obviously come from the mysterious East, but how can you be so laser precise about these dates? Mullah says, it was simple. I was here 4 years ago. At that time, you mentioned those dates. And what is this about? You know, literally and metaphorically, it's always later than you think. In life. And so, my friends, with that thought, I thank you so much for listening to me. And let's just have a few moments of silence. I'll now introduce the hymn of Kabir, just after a few seconds of silence. Okay. Kabir was a mystic 15th century in India who was both a Muslim and a Hindu. And by the way, this is something for all of us to consider. We can have what is called multiple belonging. 15th century rural mystic, both a Muslim and a Hindu. And so when he died, the Muslims claimed he was Muslim. The Hindus claimed he was Hindu. They fought over his corpse. Then the spirit of Kabir came and said, beloved ones, Muslims and Hindus, take off the shroud. Undo the shroud. And they did. And what did they find? A bouquet of flowers. And he said, divide the flowers between you. So a beautiful mystic who embraced all religions, who was a true, authentic human being, a lover of spirit. Thank you.